I'll be speaking today about a particular alternative theory of gravity that those of us at the University of Maryland have tried to call the Einstein-Ito theory, but for some reason this name hasn't caught on. But I like the way it combines two words that seem to be in conflict with each other. The essential aspect of this theory is that it is a diffeomorphism invariant theory of gravity that has a preferred frame in it. The frame is dynamical, which is how the diffeomorphism invariance is preserved, but at the same time it allows for preferred frame effects for violations of Lorentz invariance. The frame will be defined by a vector field that is constrained to be time-like and have a unit norm at every point in the spacetime. This theory follows in a long line of studies of vector tensor theories of gravity that a lot of work by Will and Nordfeldt in the 70s on unconstrained vector tensor theories. Gasparini in the 80s broke down a slightly different version of this, and the theory, as I'll discuss today, was really put down by Jacobson and Mattingly in about 2000. So the reason why you should all be interested in this theory has to do with the fact that you should be interested in the possibility of violations of Lorentz invariance. There are specific signs from specific theories of quantum gravity, including string theory and loop quantum gravity and non-commutative field theories, that Lorentz invariance may not be a perfect symmetry in nature. More generally, you might just note that we haven't tested Lorentz invariance to arbitrarily high energies, and so it's simply a good scientific question to ask, is it possible for them to be theories that violate it, but are still consistent with observations today. So in that sense, you can think of this theory as giving us a glimpse of quantum gravity effects. Or you can simply say to yourself, this is some alternative theory of gravity. It makes predictions that I can compare with observations, and that will tell me whether or not the theory is allowable or not. Now, it would be really nice if the theory were actually good for something in the sense of solving some puzzles, the dark energy problem, the dark matter problem, seeding inflation or something. But at this point, it doesn't really seem to do much. That's something for you all to do. You can go home and find a use for this. Actually, people have started to think about I just spoke with Glenn Starkman at Case Western, and he started to look at slightly more complicated versions of the very simple form of the theory that I'll discuss today, and looking at whether it actually can serve as the ether can serve as a source of dark matter and things like that.
But isn't the Bernstein theory basically the Einstein-Ito theory, is that?
What he's shown is that the Bekenstein's relativistic formulation of Mond could follow from a more complicated version of the theory that I'm about to talk about. But in that sense, yeah, it is an Einstein-Ito theory in the way I've defined it on this slide. But it turns out to be a kind of it's a non-polynomial Lagrangian in the derivatives of the ether.
It's not 5 or 6 difficult.
Yeah, it's not what?
It does have 5 or 6 other good properties.
Right.
Could it explain the GDK cutoff?
Could it explain the cutoff? Well, the cutoff is, what do you mean?
No, you don't see a GZK.
Ah, well, we do see a GZK cutoff. So it doesn't need to be, its absence doesn't need to be explained.
Well, that's the thing that could be.
Well, there is some evidence of violations of GZK cutoff. Maybe we'll have a final word next summer with the results from Auger, but.
Sure, well, any theory in which, not any theory, but in a theory in which the standard model particle is coupled to some preferred frame would allow violations of Lorentz invariance in the matter sector and could potentially describe something like not seeing GZK cutoff. But that's not really, that's not going to be an issue for me today. The point is, here's the particular action that I'll concentrate on. This is this is the most general second order Lagrangian up to a total derivative in which the unit constraint on the ether is enforced. And it turns out that there will be there are four possible terms that could be in the ether Lagrangian. What I was saying before about the non-polynomial Lagrangian for Mons is that it is polynomial in this scalar quantity here, but it's non-integer powers. So here's the scalar curvature of the metric. This is the unit constraint on the ether. This field is a Lagrange multiplier. Here we have the covariant derivative of the vector field, which contains derivatives of the metric also. We could also include a matter Lagrangian. But for today's purposes, we will assume that the matter is not directly coupled to the ether. The reason is that violations of the Lorentz symmetry and standard model interactions have been studied extensively and are highly constrained to the extent that for the purposes for my purposes, we can assume that there is no direct interaction. The question is then, given this theory, given this definition of the theory, how do we constrain these four, can we put constraints on the values of these four parameters?
So AD and MN are the same kind of indices?
Ah, okay. Yeah, these are space-time indices. And throughout the talk, I'll notate CN, UCN to notate the four C's that appear in the Lagrangian. Well, the result is this. This theory is extremely strange, and you might ask why in the world would we assume it to be somehow viable. But it turns out that there exists a one-parameter family of these theories that do pass a collection of the standard observational tests on gravitational theory. And the content of my talk will be to explain more fully this list. The constraints that I considered are those that come from post-Newtonian expansion of the theory. These are this refers to solar system tests, weak field tests. That leads to two conditions on the theory. Then we have tests coming from observations of binary pulsar systems, which leads to one additional condition. Here I mentioned weak field. This will be explained more fully later, but the point is that that pulsars are actually neutron stars, and the field inside them is not weak. But it seems appropriate to actually to treat them as weak at first, and to derive a condition, and then to consider the strong field effects as corrections to that. And those strong field effects from the pulsar systems, and a set of other constraints that I'll explain, lead to one bound on the parameters, which says they should be roughly less than about 0.1. By comparison, for Brain-Zwicky theories, which have one free parameter, the bounds on that restrict it to to be less than about 10 to the minus 6. I should emphasize that I don't mean to sell you this theory as somehow being correct or what's really out there. My point really is to use it as a proof of principle that you can have theories that with preferred frames in them, that theories with preferred frames in which the parameters appearing in the action are not constrained to be tiny, and yet the theories will pass observational tests. In a way, a hidden message is that there are precision tests of quantum gravity to the extent that a theory of quantum gravity might have a low energy limit in which there is a preferred frame. So if you happen to have a favorite theory of quantum gravity with a classical limit that is like this theory, but even if it has any classical limit, all the tests which I will discuss today will also have to be met by your theory. Oh, that's right. So let me start by telling you a little bit about the linearized limit of the theory. This will be useful later. So with Jacobson and Madden, first worked out, but they first worked out the behavior of linearized wave modes propagating on a flat metric constant ether background. As they found, there are two spin 2 modes, as in GR, standard general relativity, but also two vector or spin 1 modes and one spin 0 scalar mode. These modes all propagate at different speeds that depend on the C parameters, and those speeds are generally different from the speed of light as defined by the background metric. And then the energy densities of these linearized modes is worked out by Chris Ealing, and those two depend on the C parameters. Okay, considering these properties of the linearized wave modes leads to a set of three constraints. First is that you could ask that the energy densities be positive. Second is that you could ask that the wave speeds be real, which gives you stability in theory. And the third constraint, the third constraint that would assume that the speeds should actually be equal to or faster than the speed of light. This comes from the observation of Elliott, Moore, and Stoica that if the modes propagated at less than the speed of light, you would observe Cherenkov radiation of massless particles into these gravity ether modes. The fact that we don't observe that implies very tight constraints on the speeds of the particles such that it implies a very tight constraint on the difference between the speed of the mode and the speed of light defined by the background metric. Except that the constraint assumes that their modes are propagating less than the speed of light, so we'll simply take them to propagate a greater than that speed.
Sorry, question? Yep. The graviton can have a modifying.
That's right. Mm.
So one might think that subliminal propagation was connected to the stability.
Mm-hmm.
So, because in a situation where the speed of sound is greater than the speed of light, you often have I don't remember the argument, but in any case, your claim is that those key conditions are satisfied for some choices of those parameters.
Yes. Well, certainly they will be satisfied by a certain choice in the parameters. Yes.
Okay. So there are choices of the parameters for which the energy density is positive and then the other. I mean, that's principally important.
Yeah. Yeah, it is true that these three constraints can be satisfied at the same time by certain values.
Are you going to talk more about that?
Yeah. I wanted to first just mention one more constraint, which comes from a little bit of the cosmological effects of the field that have been already studied. If you look at the form of homogeneous isotropic solutions, there are two main effects. The first is that there's an effect of renormalization of spatial curvature of your universe. But for our purpose, in our universe is very nearly flat. And it turns out then that that effect is not interesting enough to actually give a usable constraint. However, another effect is a renormalization of the gravitational constant, which differs from the renormalization that is affected in the solar system. So there's a G cosmo, which dictates which appears in the Friedmann equation, and a G Newton, which appears in the weak field Newton's weak field limit of the theory, which is just Newton's law. And those are both dependent on the parameter C. And the difference between that leads to a difference in the rate, in the amount of helium created during the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And by looking at that, the amount that is created, you can obtain a constraint on the parameters, which was worked out by Carroll and Sean Carroll and Eugene Lim. And it's stated here at the bottom. So that gives us four constraints, the positivity constraint, stability constraint, Kopf, and the nucleosynthesis constraint. And as it will turn out, these four, and actually there's more than four, because the first three, there's really 10 constraints here, because the first three all refer to the three different spin modes. But it turns out that all of these will be satisfied. They will all reduce to just one condition when the post-Newtonian constraints that I'll come to next are satisfied. Why that is a question that I don't know the answer to. But there seems to be some kind of great coincidence between various limits of the theory that leads to a great harmony between satisfying all the constraints on the theory. So now let me tell you about post-Newtonian effects. By post-Newtonian, I mean next to Newtonian order gravitational effects predicted by your theory. There is a system. The parameterized post-Newtonian formalism, or the PPN formalism, is a way of describing these effects in terms of 10 standardized parameters and a set of fluid potentials. The values give you a way of... the parameter values can be tested in a theory-independent manner, and they give you a set of constraints that your theory must satisfy. Basically, the values of the PPN parameters predicted by your theory must match the values consistent with observation. So I said there were 10. This chart gives you a quick readout of what the values are in the Einstein-Newton theory and standard general relativity. The 6 at the bottom correspond to violations of energy and momentum conservation and are usually 0. The first two tell you about the non-linearity and the curvature of space induced by matter. And these are both 1 in both of these theories. Alpha 1 and alpha 2 describe preferred frame effects. And as you might expect in this theory, they differ from the value of GR, which is just 0. So the values are some algebraic combination of the C's. The alpha 1 was first worked out by the lowest non-trivial order in the C's by Gresser, Jenkins, and Wise, and then I calculated the exact expression in alpha 2 later on. So the observed values of these parameters are very small. they're constrained by various effects. The essential effect here is that if these are non-zero, then the theory fails to conserve angular momentum. And that allows you to constrain the values of these in different ways. For instance, for alpha 2, this strong bound comes from noting that as the solar system moves through the universe, you'd expect anomalous torques on the sun, which would cause its spin axis to be out of line with the ecliptic plane. The fact that it's not leads to this constraint. So in E theory, we have these really cumbersome expressions to deal with. Because the constraints on values of the alpha parameters are so tight, we could just say, let's set them to be zero. And that gives us two constraints, two conditions on the four parameters. Then it turns out that having imposed these two conditions, these other four constraints that I discussed earlier are satisfied as long as C1 and C3 fall within these ranges. Point out here that this is, the divisor here is 1 minus C1 plus C3. So as this approaches 1, this limit goes to infinity. So we actually have an infinite range of parameter space that will still satisfy these constraints.
So are you setting the parameters related to energy momentum violations or momentum conservation zero by hand, or?
The parameters that refer to linear momentum and energy conservation are zero.
Ones
on the bottom.
Ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are just zero. Period.
In the model.
Yeah. And observationally. Observationally, all of the values predicted by general relativity.
Okay, I will find with GR, but with your model. So your model predicts that these parameters are zero, or
that's
you're
correct.
Just fully
no. It predicts that they're zero. In fact, they must be zero for any theory that follows from an action, a relativistic action, which is pretty much any theory you'll write down.
Wait, but at least action you...
If I can write down a diffeomorphism invariant action for the theory, then these parameters will be zero. They're just kind of there for the sake of completeness. All right, so now we come to the binary pulsar test, which has been referred to by Clifford Will as the ultimate test of general relativity. Let me just tell you about a binary pulsar system. This is a binary is a pair of objects in a mutual orbit. A pulsar is a neutron star which is emitting a jet of radiation. And if that beam is not aligned with the spin axis of the star, and as it spins, the beam rotates around like a lighthouse. And if we happen to be in the line of sight of that beam, then as the star rotates, we see a regular pulsing coming from the star. If the star was stationary with respect to us, we would see a very regular sequence of arrival times. But because it's actually in a binary pulsar, because the two are actually in orbit, the pulsar is in orbit around a partner, there are Doppler shifts and gravitational redshifts and other effects that lead to variations in the time of pulse arrival. And simply by looking at those variations, you can extract a ton of data about the orbit of the binary system. This includes what are called Keplerian parameters that describe the shape of the orbit, which we assume is a Newtonian at lowest order. But there are also a set of post-Keplerian parameters, which are all zero in the Newtonian theory, but generally differ from zero due to gravitational effects. These can include a change in the orbital period, which is due to a radiation, gravitational radiation, loss of energy. Also, popular parameters include the rate of periastron shift, which is the point in the orbit when the objects are closest to each other. In a gravitational theory, this will slowly shift. Now, unfortunately, the Keplerian parameters don't tell you what the masses of the objects in the binary are, so we have to measure three post-Keplerian parameters to extract the two masses, and then perform one test on the theory. The tightest test so far sit at about 0.1%, constrain the theory to 0.1%, and these come from this particular binary, which is the pulse-Taylor binary, and what's now called the double pulsar. This is a binary system in which both objects are pulsars that we can see. And is extremely exciting, if I don't seem too excited. But the double pulsar, within just the next few years, will beat this limit by a whole lot for a variety of reasons. Just having two pulsars means we can extract the mass ratio, and so you only need two tests. You only have to measure two parameters to get one test. But the orbit is also very nearly relativistic. And this means that post-Newtonian, higher order post-Newtonian effects will become important. And that's going to push. The accuracy will become low enough that we can actually measure higher order effects in the system. So calculation, I mentioned earlier that actually neutron stars are very strongly gravitationally bound. And this means that it's, you can't assume that the fields are weak everywhere. What's traditionally done for other theories, like scalar tensor theories, Rosen's biometric theory, was to assume that the perfect fluid bodies can be treated as effectively as point particles that have non-standard couplings in their action. Here, what we could do is assume that there's a this is an example here. V is the forward velocity of the particle or the fluid, the star. U is the ether. S is some unknown. It's just an unknown parameter that could presumably be calculated from the exact theory and matching it onto this one. This should be three dots rather than lambda. So these sets of, so this is what we're going to do to calculate these pulsar effects. But the values of the sensitivities are not known. They're input from another theory. But one thing we do know, that I know, is that by comparing the weak field limit of the expressions for the pulsar from this theory with the weak field limit using the exact theory, which I can calculate, I know that the sensitivity scale like m over d, where m is the mass of a body, and d is the rough size of it, and alpha 2 and alpha 1 are the ppm parameters. But this means that when I set those two parameters to be 0, the leading term in the sensitivity is alpha 0. And so it must scale as m over d squared. And also it's going to have a factor of c out front squared, this part scales as c squared in the limit of small c, and it seems reasonable that the leading next order term will also go at least like c squared. This quantity m over d is about 0.0 1 to 0.3 for neutron stars, general relativity. For regular stars like the Sun, it's much smaller, 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 3. So this quantity is small, at least smaller than it would be in standard general relativity. And this means that to calculate the pulsar formulae, I can assume that my result, I can simply do the weak field results using the exact fluid theory, and then go back and look for the strong field corrections to it. Oh well, that should have been, this should be three dots, but the point is this is the third time derivative of these two quantities, and this is the first time derivative squared. So the calculation for the damping rate is kind of involved, but involves, I won't explain it, but what happens, the damping rate, which is the rate at which the system loses energy to radiation of gravity and ether modes, and that corresponds, well, we assume that corresponds to a loss of mechanical energy and causes the bodies to spiral into each other. The expression, you work out when the expression has been worked out by me, and the answer depends at lowest order on three quantities where Q is the quadrupole moment of the system, B is the second mass moment, which is really a monopole moment, and this here is a P, and is a dipole moment of the system. At GR, you have a similar expression, except B and C of 0, and A of 1. So we end up with, okay, so now we have this, now how do we use the binary pulsar data to constrain? What are the constraints we obtain from considering the pulsar, the predictions for the binary pulsar? It turns out there's only one new condition. First of all, if we impose that the PPM parameters are 0, then only the quadrupole term contributes to the expression for the damping rate. This again is one of these coincidences that I can't explain, but it's very curious. Secondly, at least ignoring the strong field effects, the other post-Keplerian parameters that we would consider are determined purely in terms of the PPM parameters. And since those have all been set to be the same as they are in general relativity, then the post-Keplerian parameters will also be the same.
So, can I make a query?
Yeah.
So what you had before was the quadrupole formula plus additional terms to radiate into vector and scalar modes.
Yeah.
Coming from the fact that Einstein ether theory has vector and scalar modes.
That's right.
And then from already existing data, you set this parameter alpha 1 equal to alpha 2 equals 0.
Yeah.
Okay. And that, by some calculations you're not explaining, implies that B and C are 0.
Not that B and C are 0. Well, okay, B is 0.
Okay.
And P is becomes, quantity P becomes equal to the conserved total momentum.
So it's down to 0.
Yeah.
So it's down to 0. So basically, you're saying that under that condition, a binary pulsar does not radiate into vector or scalar modes.
That's right.
Okay. But does that imply that if you go back to your original parameterization of the theory, then in fact, you just have no excitation of the vector and scalar modes?
No.
Good.
Yeah. Okay.
So you still have propagating vector and scalar modes in theory with those parameters, but somehow they don't couple to the binary pulsar.
No, they contribute to the quadrupole moment, but for some reason the monopole and dipole contributions are not. When I say monopole and dipole, this monopole moment does not come just from the scalar mode.
Okay, so if they couple still to the quadrupole moment, then A is not necessarily still the general relativity value.
That's right. Exactly. But that's the next, that's the third condition. let A be 1. Having set the other post-Keplerian parameters, I mean, having noted that those other parameters are equal to the GR one, then the predictions for the binary pulsar, if we could ignore the strong field terms, will be the same as long as the radiation rates are the same. And that means just requiring that, that coefficient A be equal to the GR value of 1. This is a graph. C plus is C1 plus C3. This is C1 minus C3. The solid line is the line along which that coefficient A equals 1 here. The dotted line underneath is the boundary of the region that is allowed by those other constraints I mentioned earlier. And so everything underneath the dotted line is allowed by those constraints. And so up here, the theory is allowed. Down here, it seems to be not allowed, but as we'll come to in a minute, when I consider corrections to the expression, the A equals 1 line will fatten up and overlap down here. But the fact that it's allowed up here means that the theory, the parameters in the theory are not constrained to be very small. It can, in fact, be order 1.
But just to come back to the physics, I mean, if you're saying, if those parameters are not small, then you have vector and scalar modes with a gravitational strength.
Yeah.
So why isn't, so naively, without doing any calculation, you would expect that the binary pulsar would be way off, but also would be radiating into vector and scalar modes at a rate equal to the gravitational strength. So how are you evading that?
How?
Well, I mean, if the conclusion of your talk was that the binary pulsar strongly constrains the Einsteinian theory because getting the binary pulsar right means there are no vector and scale modes,
yeah,
then I would understand intuitively
right. What the message okay. was.
So I want to understand how there can still be vector and scale modes and not screw up the binary pulsar.
Yeah. Intuitively, I guess, well, I don't know why. It's an interesting coincidence. Because the speeds of the modes are different, I think it's correct to say that the rate at which it radiates, no. There's somehow the fact that the speeds of the modes are not all equal to the speed of light means that the pulsar can radiate in all those modes, and somehow the rate, total rate still sums up to be equal to the GR rate. I think it's got it. But the deep reason why that is, I can't tell you. The and signs should be dots, point being that this is the E dot, delta E dot. Okay, let's consider corrections to the formulas. There are two sources of corrections. The first is that there's an observational error in the measurements, which I mentioned before. The smallest is about 10 to the minus 3 relative to the size of the observed value. And then when I go back and consider the strong field corrections for the expressions, I expect the relative size to be of order c squared times the sensitivity squared. And if the sensitivity is about 0.3, let's say, then this is about 0.1 times c squared. So I can then ask that the strong field terms give contributions that are smaller than this observational error so that the weak field reading order terms still match. And just comparing these two leads to a constraint on C that would be roughly smaller than 10 to the minus 1. I'm giving you a kind of tentative rough constraint because the work on the strong field corrections is still in progress. Also, I could allow A to be different from 1 by enough so that the reading order terms are also still. By letting A be different from 1, there are corrections to the leading order terms that are leading order, in a sense, but I can still ask it to be smaller than the error, and that allows me to fatten up that line And as it turns out, if you go down to where I said the C should be less than, then fattening up the line does indeed cause it to overlap the allowed region. Okay. The conclusion. This particular Einstein-Euler theory appears to survive all of these constraints without down-tuning, at least for now. Where by down-tuning, I mean you'd expect that if I simply make the parameters in the Lagrangian smaller and smaller, the effects will eventually be small enough that I can't see them. But in this case, they can still be, relatively speaking, large, and yet the theory is observationally okay. For now, because I expect that the double pulsar, which I mentioned, will lead to stronger constraints that will start to push the theory. So there are a variety of things you can do. Calculate the higher order corrections. Look for detection. If we have a working gravity wave detector, we can start to look for these spin 1 and 0 modes that the theory predicts. And really that any theory with almost any theory with a vector mode in it is going to predict spinning stars. This last one is really probably as interesting as the whole rest of my talk. This is something that we started to talk about at Maryland. There was a paper by a couple of guys who I believe are Russian, Sibirikov and Dubovsky, who argued that in a theory like this, where you generically, in a generic theory where you have Lorentz violations of Lorentz symmetry are really a preferred frame in a gravitational context, then you can have violations of the second law of thermodynamics, which you achieve by turning a black hole into a perpetual motion machine. The essential effect is that because in these theories you have these modes, you tend to have these modes that propagate at different speeds, have different limiting speeds, and so in effect they see a different causal structure in the spacetime. And so, for instance, a black hole for one mode, if one mode sees a black hole, another mode traveling at a different limiting speed will see a black hole inside that one, possibly outside. The difference in the areas of black holes leads to a difference in the walking temperature of the black hole for the different modes. And this turns out to allow you to imagine a setting in which you have energy transferred from a cold shell of one type of mode to a hot shell of another. So we started talking about this, assuming that it had to be wrong, and so far we just can't find any reason why it's wrong. So you should all be very interested in this, because it potentially gives you a way of ruling out all theories in which there are preferred frame effects in a gravitational setting. Still a few big questions. As I said before, it'd be nice if the theory were really good for something. And it'd be nice to know, for instance, do we have a quantum gravity theory that really gives us this type of classical theory as it would? These are also questions that you should all be very interested in, and I hope you'll go out and answer them. Okay.
Yeah, this mode we were talking about.
Yeah.
I'm not globally defined when I was R-cubed to space-time.
The modes? Not globally.
This mode, you define this mode with respect to time actually in the field, right? So, but you don't have such a global notion as R-cubed geometry.
Are you talking about the black hole?
Yeah, I'm talking about the black hole thing. You were talking about modes traveling with different...
Well, if I'm talking about a static solution, then there's a global... But you shouldn't ask me questions about that, because you'll have to be asking me questions about someone else's argument.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two questions actually. That are related to each other. So you've said a lot about astrophysics. I'm wondering, what about cosmological constraints like structure formation?
Uh-huh.
And based on this, kind of, what's your story as to where the vector field comes from?
As far as structure formation is a specific thing that, well, I mentioned one constraint that does come from cosmology. And then, but other than that, we haven't looked at anything. But there are people, like a group at Case Western. There are other people who are looking at that, and what they tell me is the particular example I talked about today doesn't give you structure forms. But there are more complicated types that do. And this would be, for example, the version of the theory that seems to give you a relativistic Mond theory. So that's something that's up and coming, I guess you could say. As to where the vector field comes from, that's also something that I don't have an opinion on. The theory, the work I've done on the theory was more of to illustrate that if you had a theory of this type, you would make certain predictions and you could test it. There are a variety of different ways you could imagine coming up with this theory, I suppose.
Well, it was kind of the same question as Sabine, you know, about because, I mean, essentially you're saying, well, you know, there might be this scalar mode, which is massless, not propagating at the speed of light, mm-hmm. and as long as it doesn't work with matter, it's, you know, it can be there.
Yeah.
So that's very surprising. So, yeah, those are kind of the same questions about how does it change the story of inflation, but I guess you're right.
Maybe
you should put that on the to-do list.
Yeah. I thought I had it.
Because you would expect.
I used to.
I mean, having this, you know. Sorry.
Yeah, the theory, it's totally not intuitive. You think it would be a disaster once you started comparing it with observations, but it does pretty well, and that's very surprising. Mm-hmm.
So,
maybe
I can just ask a question for my understanding, which is, so in the action, can you go back to the
yeah.
action? So you can see that as some action gravity comes to some funny matter source.
Here?
Yeah, to some, so you, if you see the vector field as some funny matter source. So do you consider like the prediction of your theory only in dependence of your C parameters, or also on the initial conditions for the U field? You get, and if you would say make some start at some initial conditions,
mm-hmm.
you get kind of initial conditions for the verification of fields, but you may get also initial conditions for the vector field U. And under the theory, the predictions might change in dependence of these initial conditions. So do you get also constraints on these? Or?
Well, that's the initial conditions?
Well, it's actually more. The first question would be: you get degrees of freedom coming from the vector field.
Okay.
So you have initial conditions for the vector field. And my question is more or less: how far away are you from the usual theory if you change these initial conditions for the vector field?
I still don't understand. I just don't. Initial conditions. In what sense? If I consider a 3+1 version?
Suppose you start with your vector field at the beginning of the universe pointing, you know, uniformly way away from the cosmological rest plane.
Okay.
Would that lead to, supposing it's now pointed way away from the cosmological rest plane?
Yeah, okay.
It seems like it can make really bad effects just by making you point really far, you know, be a highly, highly boosted frame.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yes. There probably would be big effects if it was.
So you start with some assumption.
Okay, yeah, so I started with the implicit assumption that the background vector field does line up with the cosmological restraint.
Okay. Yeah. My question to get a better feeling with these theories are, suppose I take it out the U field, and you know, get an action purely in terms of the metric, which is diffuse time, and then we can just left the scalar field.
Right.
That will be, so.
Someone asked me that, and.
Very diffuse work, yeah.
And my response was, well, maybe the one, but the answer, I really don't know.
Well, I guess you're going to get a non-local action. Okay, you didn't, because you cannot reformulate this whole theory just purely in terms of the default theory, default environment theory for metric. Then from this point of view, it's harder to understand. Okay, the scalar mode is there, the vector mode is harder to understand. Okay, let's look at that.
So I was going to ask about the status of similar ideas, because this is related to a question we were talking about before. You could imagine having a curlless vector time vector field instead of your idea, which would define a foliation. And I was wondering, you say that this one is doing quite well experimentally, you don't have to do any, you don't have to make the graphs very, very small. And I was just wondering if you knew what the status of these other things are. Is this sort of experimentally preferred in some sense? Is it the other ones doing as well?
Joe is referring to theories in which instead of a vector, you just write down, replace the vector with the divergence of a scalar function. And these typically go by the name of something like ghost condensate. And the answer is the people who tend to work on those theories haven't done a thorough job, I would say. So I don't know what the answer is. And I personally haven't taken those theories and worked out. Although I suppose it probably just follows from the results I've already got somehow.
Why do you have this out there? I mean, you put it positively, but is the following the description of your results? There's a four-dimensional parameter space there.
Mm-hmm.
The results of, so there are first theoretical constraints.
Yes.
Say positive energy stability. And they reduce you, I'm sort of reading in the data use you to some two-dimensional subspace and a four-dimensional space.
Yeah.
Okay, so that if I pick random C1, C2, C3, C4, I would just violate constant energy and I would be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question about this. So already, for example, the Bekenstein theory, or any randomly chosen theory of this kind, is then very likely to violate positivity of energy unless it's very cleverly chosen. Do you know whether it is?
Bekenstein's theory. Well, that one I can't directly compare because it has an additional mode in the theory. So another scalar.
But you could just take the sector, which is a vector field.
Okay, the vector field sector is just like Einstein Maxwell, just has an F squared. And that does fine. But it appears to have other problems. Something like there are caustics where the evolution of the field is not defined or something.
So let me then just ask my next question. So then you, having gone down to a two-dimensional surface and four-dimensional space by theoretical consideration, you then impose all the experiments that we know. And you're saying you find that you can barely live, just barely, because you're pretty close, along a one-dimensional curve in a four-dimensional space, which is a very complicated function of C1, C2, C3, C4 is equal to a constant. So you're almost dead. You're just epsilon away from being dead.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah. what you're saying is I've cut down a four-dimensional parameter space to a subset of the one-dimensional space.
Yeah, which is not even very natural. It's just a complicated curve. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could say that too. The fact is still remain, though, that the message still remains that there are these constraints that the theory has to satisfy. And if your theory doesn't satisfy these strange constraints, which really reduce you to one freedom, then it's not going to do well.
Right, so the message is, if you thought you had a quantum theory of gravity that broke momentum variance, and you aim for something like this as an effective action, you're almost certainly dead, because it's very unlikely that your theory of quantum gravity is going to know about that complicated relationship between C1, C2, C3, and C4 that's on some of your previous slides.
Yeah. I like the way yes.
So if you look at quantizers, you mean would you quantize just symmetric or
You could do both. I think Ted Jacobson and Chris Ewing started to do that in 2+1 metrics. Had the idea, the motivation being that the vector field can serve as a preferred frame and help with the problem of time in the theory. Is it topological? Yeah. The vector field gives you local degrees of freedom. Okay. But I think they actually found every possible solution. They solved it. Okay. Maybe that was 1+1.
Yeah, I think it was 1+1. The article was in the archive a couple of days ago.
A couple of days ago?
Yeah, it was a new article.
Oh, I'm coming in. And he's in my office.
Okay. Okay.